MSW Media.
Prevail, c'est un show de Genève programme pro-politico.
L'histoire, la sécurité nationale.
Crimine organizzato, dinero sucio.
Globale corruzione. Ta brutto sa democrazia.
Et ora?
ATP.
Et maintenant?
Con ustedes, su anfitrión.
Greg Oléa.
Welcome Aix the Fight. This time I know our side will win.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. Stephen Beschloss is here. Stephen is a journalist, an author, a professor, a filmmaker. He's done lots of different interesting things, and he writes a terrific Substack called America, America, which he's been doing since right after the insurrection, so 2.5 years now. One of my favorite Substacks, and I encourage everybody to go check that out. It's just america.substack.com. We talk about a lot of things. Up front, we talk about the current political situation, about Trump and how the media is covering Trump and how the media has failed, continues to fail. And then we talk about some of his stuff. He has a book that he wrote about Lee Harvey Oswald called The Gunman and His Mother, Lee Harvey Oswald, Marguerite Oswald, and the Making of an Assassin. So I wanted to have him on just to talk about that because I think the JFK stuff is interesting. So that was a particularly interesting part of the discussion. And then we talked about Biden and, you know, President Biden, his many, many accomplishments, what the media thinks of him, where the election might be going, where Stephen thinks he fits in historically. And of course, you guys know what I think about that. Yeah, again, great conversation. Stephen's somebody I've known on Twitter for a long time and I've never met before. So it was a great pleasure for me to have him on the show. Stick around for that. I don't have much up front. I'm scanning the news stories. It's Thursday morning. It's 5:15 a.m. I'm scanning the news stories. Everything sucks. You know, Putin has vowed to continue the war. There's going to be no peace, he says, until his war objectives are met, to which I'll add, or unless you drop dead, because that would also end the war. It's just a sad joke that this guy is in power. It's a sad joke, just a sham, the fact that he's even pretending that this is an election like a normal country. And it's pathetic that the Republicans here in the United States are just lining up to kiss this guy's feet. It's really disgusting. Not giving aid to Ukraine is basically helping Putin. Not basically, it just is. Ukraine needs the aid. And if we give them the aid, they will win. And that's what we want. We want them to win and defeat Russia, comma, our enemy for the last 7,500 years, comma, without us having to do anything. All we have to do is give them arms. This is not complicated. We don't want American boots on the ground, but if Putin wins in Ukraine, he's going to keep going. And if he invades, say, Poland, then we're all drawn into a war. Do we want that? No, we do not want that. So the obvious, easy thing to do is to support Ukraine as much as we can in the war, as I've been saying on this podcast, even before the invasion, right? Ukraine right now, the fight could not be more basic. It is an occupying force, a real, true occupying force, you know, versus the people that live there. It is evil versus good, in a sense, you know, that they don't need to be there. They're doing terrorist stuff, war crimes every day. You know, my friend Zarina Zabriskie has been on this show many times at this point, reporting from Kherson and elsewhere, talking about all the atrocities committed by the Russians. It's also atrocities against their own people, by the way. I read a thing where there's like 300,000 Russians have died in Ukraine, which is, I mean, come on. Why do we want this? He's, you know, he's starting now to make it so people can't leave without signing up for military service. He's basically condemning an entire generation of Russian men to die. And why? For what fucking purpose? There is no purpose. His own bloated, idiotic, stupid ambitions, you know, to reunite the Soviet Union, whatever the fuck I don't know what goes on in that stupid head of his, but it doesn't make any sense. It's ridiculous. You already have the biggest country on the planet. Just be happy. Nobody wants to invade your stupid country, Vlad. Sit down, relax. So I don't know what's going to happen here. The Europeans seem to be okay with pushing back on him. Although there's, you know, there's tensions in some of these countries now, in Hungary, now in Slovakia, you know, with leaders who are on Putin's side. That horrible Viktor Orban guy, you know, he was a bagman for Mogilevich. He's a fucking mobster. He's a tool of the Russian mob. Somehow he's running Hungary. Of course he's on Putin's side. And Tucker's on his side. So that tells you all you need to know. I don't know. I see this very clearly. This is just a battle between democracy and fascism. And I don't know how it could be any more clear. So I'm on the side of democracy. I think everybody listening to this is also on the side of democracy. We need to make sure that everybody out in the wild who doesn't pay attention to politics understands what's at stake here. And Stephen and I talk about this a bit on the pod. The media is not doing a great job telling everybody what the stakes are. This is something Jay Rosen of NYU came up, the media professor, you know, report about the stakes. You know, in other words, don't worry about the horse race. Don't worry about the polling. Talk about the stakes of who's going to win the election. If Trump wins, what's going to happen? Well, I've written about it on my Substack. You know, guy is going to be a dictator. That's what he wants to do. He's now at rallies saying this and people are cheering him. So we do not want this fucking rapist criminal to be a dictator, okay? And don't tell me that, oh, well, you know, that'll never happen. Why? What evidence are you using to support that? Because he's going to go in there and he's going to do whatever the fuck he wants, and he's going to install weirdo, competent people to do his bidding. I don't know. I can't put it any more starkly than that. This next election is really, it will be the last election if Trump wins, period. Or the last real one. You know, I understand Putin is running for re-election now too. So I guess there will be elections, but they'll be meaningless. And that's it. We're going to be stuck with these people. So let's not be stuck with these people. Let's make sure that everybody out there knows all the good stuff Biden has been doing. And more importantly, that not voting for him is voting for Trump. And Trump wants to be a dictator. And that's what he's going to do. This isn't hyperbole. I'm not chicken littling this shit. He said it. His followers have said it. This is the plan. So, you know, grim stuff as we head into the holiday season, but we have to address it. We have to address it now, or we won't have the luxury of addressing it ever again. So, on that cheery note, it was a great conversation with Stephen Beschloss. I enjoyed it. So I'm going to stop my prattle and we'll be right back with Stephen Beschloss.
Hey, it's Nunzio Ciccarelli, president of the Bank of the Bada Bing, Jersey's finest financial services firm. I'm here to tell you about a new online dating app made by wise guys for wise guys. Mobster. That's mobster, without the E, because who the fuck knows why? Need to replace your gumad? Looking for a date for your big weekend in Boca? Did Christiane Allen quit as your press secretary? Whether you're an enforcer, a racket guy, some corrupt attorney or judge, or the head of one of the five families, Mobster's the best place to find some action. And hey, we won't sell your data like that lying sack of shit Mark Zuckerberg. Some people got ethics. Mobster, you swipe left, I'll break your fucking hand. And now, back to the show.
Stephen Beschloss, welcome to Prevail.
Great to be with you, Greg.
You and I have known each other, I guess, on Twitter and on social media for quite some time. I lost all track of time. We were talking about this a little before we, you know, I don't know what happened before the pandemic, after. I think because of the pandemic, my sense of timing is all off. But it's exciting to have you on and talk to you because I've read your Substack now for, when did you launch it? It's been a while now, right? You were pretty early.
Well, I launched it the month after the insurrection. So that would be the end of February 2021. So it's 2.5 years.
Yeah. Congratulations. It's called America, America. I read it all the time and I think it's a really good one. You do a great job. And what I like about it the most is that you always come at it from a place of hope, which is something I always try to do. Sometimes you can't, but, you know, but I think you're very good at finding the hopeful elements and things. And I think I don't, even when you're writing about like horrible things, which, you know, you're often writing about horrible things, I never leave your column feeling like
you know, like I want to go put my head in the oven or something. I feel like,
right,
you know, hopeful about it. So, and it's hard to do that. So, you know, I think you do a really good job.
Thank you. And I would say it's called America, America. There's not one America. There's many Americas, but what there surely is an America that deserves an ode, that deserves a tribute, that deserves to be like honored and recognized for its beauty and its possibility. And then there's that other place. And so, you know, the challenge, the necessity is to do both, right? To capture both. And it's true. It's always tricky sometimes when you're talking about, you know, the onslaught of dictatorship or, right, you know, extreme violence or the constant flood of violent rhetoric and on and on and on. It's hard to find the hopeful place, and you don't want to do it in a Pollyannish way. It has to be authentic. So I appreciate your comment.
Yeah. And you do. And I think it's great. I was going to ask you about the title, because I sort of assumed it was in America, America. But again, it's the two different Americas. It's good. I like that. Okay. So your background, you have quite a background. You've done a lot of different things. You've had bylines in enviable publications, New Yorker, New York Times, WAPO. You're nominated for a Pulitzer. You've written books on America and also on Lee Harvey Oswald and his mom, which we're going to get to in a little while. You're a professor. You've made documentary films. You've done feature films. And I guess you've stayed at the Ritz-Carlton a lot. that's what I get from the bio. Now you have this this new project, and you have the video, this Media Misses with Mark Jacob. So I wanted to talk about, and I especially with people who I know from Twitter and I've known for a long time, what prompted you to sort of pivot into covering all of the Trump stuff kind of all the time? Because before you weren't. A lot of these things are not about Trump at all, and they're about other things. So what was there an origin story for you? How did you decide to do this?
Yeah, there is an origin story that you can really trace from the early days of Trump, I have to say. I mean, I used to be that person. I was never simply a news reporter. I was always looking for point of view. I was always looking for a first-person perspective on things. I was always looking for a way to tell a story that got to something deeper beyond breaking news. On the other hand, so I did a lot of feature work and in a lot of different sort of intellectual realms, kind of current affairs realms. But what was true was that in those early years, it became clear it wasn't good enough just to enunciate facts without saying what I thought and what I felt, that it became increasingly important to say what's right and what's wrong, what's true and what's false, what's normal and what's crazy. And that if we didn't do that, we had the risk of people with the daily onslaught, the constant degrading, not only of sort of the truth, but people's capacity to know what's true and false. And so it was clear to me early on that I couldn't sort of hide behind, if you will, the traditional notions about a journalist who's, you know, only providing a kind of neutral perspective of multiple points of view and is never saying what they actually think is right or wrong. And so I decided to do that. I started to do that more aggressively. I was, you know, posting 10, 12 times a day. I felt that there was a lot that needed to be said. And the result of that is that the whole thing just sort of, you know, went crazy. I mean, it just really escalated and escalated and escalated. What I discovered is that people actually in these times really needed people who were articulating what the hell is going on and help them to sort of think through what was going on. And so people found value in what I was sharing. I would also just sort of, if I can sort of roll forward, if you get to 2021, now it's the month of the insurrection. And I'd written some, opinion pieces for the Washington Post. I was doing, you know, other sort of traditional things for traditional outlets. But what was increasingly important was to talk about what was happening after January 6th. And that month, I mean, I have to say, I had 60 million impressions that month, about 10% engagement rate. It was crazy, like kind of engagement, like 2 million a day. It was crazy. And it just told me in a way that I was able to see over the years is just how intensely people were feeling. And you know, that really kind of evolved into starting America, America and the Substack of my own.
I think it's great, as I, you know, as I've said, and I think it's also great that you decided to do that, because I think it's, I come at this from, I was a novelist once upon a time, and a lot of people that I know from the literary world just didn't do anything. You know, they just kept on writing their novels about some what, and it's like, you know, I don't know what you're doing, but this, the world is on fire. You know, this is not the time for that.
Not to be too moral about it, but I felt like I had a duty to my country. I mean, I really did. And I likewise couldn't understand all the people who chose to stay out, who felt it was okay not to say anything, or for whatever reasons, they were in worlds where they felt they couldn't say anything.
That's true too. And I think it's important to have, you know, your skill specifically, which is one of narrative, you know, telling a story and being able to look at, you know, there's this thing happened and that thing happened and this other thing happened over here. How do they relate together? I think that's the thing that people need the most help with. And right. That's the thing that the media doesn't really right. provide. It doesn't provide context. And that's just how it works. That's how newspapers are. They tell you what happened today, and then they sort of assume that you know the best. It's like watching a soap opera to some degree. They assume you right. know what happened before, even though, especially now, you kind of don't. And, it, you know, how do you jump in? How do you tell the story? So I think that's great. Now you've released this. There's this video. It's called, it is called Media Misses. Is that's the name of it, with Mark Jacobs. So this is pretty new. So tell us about that. How does it differ from the Substack?
Yeah. So Mark is a former Metro editor of Chicago Tribune. I connected with him actually in Chicago at one point. I actually connected him with him first on social media, and then reached out to him in the real world. And what I saw was that he had pretty strong media criticism. He had left the Chicago Tribune had something important and interesting to say regularly. He actually wrote a couple of columns for America America, so I got a chance to work with him and to get a feeling of him as a writer. But then we started to talk about, and I just had this idea that the need for media criticism to focus on what journalists were doing wrong, and I'm focusing on the wrong, you know, who were, you know, political reporters who were just covering what's going on now as a political story, a horse race, not a crime story, not a story about the survival of democracy. And to me, they were missing so many things. And, you know, while we want to focus on a lot of the bigger issues that are going on, oftentimes the way in which those stories are covered gets lost. And, you know, as you and I know, the framing of the stories, the headlines about those stories is often as far as people get to figuring out what actually happened. So the idea was, let's do this regularly. We first talked bi-week. We would probably do it weekly. So far, we're doing it weekly. Super short, like 5 to 7 minutes. Just pick one story, look at it as closely as we can, get in, get out, say what's working, say what's not. And, you know, hopefully over time, this sort of collection will provide some ability to motivate a few people that maybe they should do things a little differently.
I like him a lot. He's one of my favorite Twitter follows. Mark is, and you know, the criticism of the media, I think, is it's just super important. So I was going to talk about this later, but since we brought it up, let's go into it now about the journalism, because you know, in 2016, I think it's fair to say that the media failed. I my chapter in my book is The Fourth Estate Crapped the Bed, and I think, you know, the reasons why are manifold. I mean, Manafort and manifold. You know, I think they covered Trump like he was a celebrity, like he was a curiosity, like he didn't have any chance of winning. And they really didn't treat him like, they didn't vet him the way that they would.
Don't take him seriously.
Right, right. And I think that was part of the problem. And then in their defense, I think, you know, the media had never been in this situation before where they had to cover somebody like this. And they just couldn't figure it out.
Right.
Now, 8 years later, we're still making enormous mistakes covering this guy. So why do you think that is? Why can't the media cover this guy properly?
You know, it's almost a matter of a social convention first, which is people feel the need to be courteous and maybe even to assume that people will do the right thing eventually. And if they do the wrong thing, that it's an error, that it's not who they are. And so it's taken an awfully long time for people to get over this idea that when, you know, he's pouring out all of his lies day after day after day, and they're just being called claims or gently falsehoods, or just not saying that lies are lies, right? That was one thing. In New York Times, Washington, I mean, all of the major papers took a long time before they called lies lies. And it's that kind of attempt at neutrality, but courtesy, which is just exactly the place that Trump has loved to and does by instinct exploit.
Yeah, that's a good that's a good point. I mean, yeah, he exploits everybody's good nature, I think, to some
degree. Yeah, and I think that's true. I mean, I think that's true in every walk of life, right? People who are his vendors, and he ends up screwing them, or people who are in the court system who think that he'll follow norms and traditions until he doesn't, and then don't know what to do. So I don't want to hold journalism separate from all other realms of life. I think these things are connected, but the tradition of so-called objectivity or so-called neutrality, the desire to show what both sides are on any given topic and not necessarily weighing in on what's right or wrong, what's true or false. I think that that's worked against being able to address this guy in the way that he needed to be addressed, because he's not playing the game that everyone else is. And so the rules do not apply.
Yeah, no, they don't. And then the journalism in general, it's not a monolith also. Like, I feel like, you know, obviously lots of journalists did great work, because I know everything that I know that happened because I read it in the newspaper. It's not like I had sources right. Certainly at that time. And yet the framing of it and I can feel like the editorial meetings just, pushing back on the narrative. Oh, no. We don't want to
just say what happened. Say it directly.
Yeah.
Don't just gloss over it. Don't just sort of, get to it in a gentle way that he's going in a different direction. This kind of thing. Say that he's aiming for dictatorship. Don't say he's veering toward the right, or just there's always been a lot of language that's been used to try to soften the danger that's in our midst. And that's got to stop. I mean, I've tried to say over these years, the reason why I've worked really hard to try to say things more directly, as strongly as I can. And what I'm constitutionally sort of inclined not to be incendiary, but when your house is on fire, you need to act accordingly. You can't just say, that there's a fire over here and there's firemen coming and we're going to get some water and there's a problem that's coming. Well, no, the house is on fire and it's about to burn down. Say so. And if the anarchist is in the room, say so.
The fact that the New York PitchBot, that account on Twitter, which is so great as satire, has been operating for as long as it has, and the time still hasn't fucking changed, is emblematic of the problem, which is that they can't, especially in the headlines, they just can't get away from the way that they've decided to frame everything.
The other thing is this need to try to be amusing also.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm, I'm all for humor. I'm all for irony and a good laugh. But again, when we're talking about something that represents the seriousness, the genuine danger to the survival of democracy, it's not a good idea to take it light in your coverage.
I mean, to your point, when Ivanka Trump went to testify in the New York case, which is a big deal. This is the case of the guy that used to be the president who's going to run for president again. He's going to be the nominee. It's a huge fraud case. The Times basically sent a fashion reporter to talk about what they were all wearing. And that was one of the top, kind of stories in the thing. What's Ivanka wearing? How is it different? Yeah. Now, not that shouldn't be written about in the fashion section, fine, but they gave it like this sort of front page coverage as if that was the only way to talk about the story.
And look, that puts a responsibility on people like you and people like me and other people who see what's going on to say things as directly as we can. And look, it's always this question. I think we went through some years where mockery try to humiliate him, to sort of just show how not just ludicrous, but how just, you know, batshit crazy he is, to do that and hope that that would break through. But I think we're beyond that, in my view. I think we're at a point now where you just need to say things as intensely as you can about what the dangers are. And, you know, and look, also to say, and this is for me the point about hope or optimism, those outcomes are not inevitable. The majority of the country, you know, still believes in democracy, even if, you know, that majority is waning. You know, the majority of the country still wants compassion and decency in public life. I mean, I think that there's enough that's on our side that if we can continue to expand people's capacity to imagine the future, right, what that future looks like, then we just might be able to motivate enough people to, you know, get off their couches and do something.
I think you're right. I mean, we certainly have the numbers. And also part of my brain is like, you know, dude, he lost by 8 million votes last time. How is he he's going to win by more now? Like, who's voting right for this clown?
Right.
But, you know, to your point, it's also the danger is much more intense now. I think the stakes are much higher. On our live YouTube show that we do, the 5-8, we had Jen Mercia was on last night, and she was talking about the idea of comparing Trump to Hitler, and that Trump actually wants to be compared to Hitler because Hitler was a big strong man and he wants right to present himself as a strong man. I mean, he's made no secret of, you know, his desire to be a dictator. The media seems to be coming around. I mean, do you think people understand the threat, or do you think we're just too many people out to lunch?
Well, I think that we have a problem with indifference, right? I mean, we know that more than a third of the country didn't vote in 2020. There was a danger then. It wasn't confusing to most Americans. That's why Biden ended up in the office. But I think indifference remains sort of at the center of things in terms of people feeling like, oh, maybe he wasn't that bad, or, you know, maybe it won't be so bad, or, you know, I have a problem with him on this issue or that issue. And, you know, obviously now we're looking at people who are, you know, pro-Palestinian, or who are looking at his policy in terms of the Israel-Hamas war and saying like, oh, I'll never vote for Joe Biden. And well, I'm sorry, to do what? To let what happen? So there's a lot of different ways that people are, in my view, minimizing what's happened. And so I think, and what can happen. So I think that the work between now and next November is, you know, methodically, compulsively, hopefully not boringly, but to, you know, week after week after week, to keep getting at this one way or another.
Yeah, I think we have to. Robert Kagan, who's not, you know, to be confused with some tree-hugging liberal, wrote two big columns in the Washington Post. The first one, very, very pessimistically saying, yeah, the dictatorship's coming and we're really fucked. That's the, you know, too long didn't read version. And yeah, then I think they got so much flack about it that they made him write a, hey, what can we do about this column? And most of what he wants to do is he puts the blame on basically the establishment Republicans, like Mitt Romney and Nikki Haley and, you know, people like a Paul Ryan, who were maybe a little bit removed from Trump and could, if they united and chose to talk, could. And the only person really doing that now is Liz Cheney.
Right.
Do you think that these people are going to come around, or I don't know. And why don't they? Right. Mitt Romney's just, he's retiring. What does he care? Why can't he talk to right. speak the truth?
Who wants to write the book on the Republican history of spinelessness? Right. It's shooting fish in the bucket, right? Whatever that is, shooting the fish in the barrel. It's pretty obvious that the utter inability of Republicans to say what they know is in front of their eyes is shocking. And, you know, what we've learned, fear and intimidation, the threat of violence, the fear that if you speak out, it's going to affect your family, that the death threats and all the other things that we know about are coming for you if you dare to speak out against the malignant one. And I mean, so I I don't want to minimize what has evolved, which is that even Republicans are afraid, and they're, you know, legitimately afraid. You know, we know who's gotten attacks and, you know, who's faced violence, judges and you know, witnesses, and we can go through the whole litany of people who have. But, you know, the thing about Kagan's point is that for me, is he talked about 13 weeks, that there's 13 weeks until Super Tuesday. And by then, basically, Trump will have it locked up. So if you think that, well, it's next November, well, no, it's not next November, it's 13 weeks. And what that means, as he puts it, and I think he's right, is that then whatever resistance there may have been within the Republicans is going to evaporate, because then they think he's presumptive, he's prohibitive, he's the guy, you know, we better get in line. And so, you know, that puts a lot of pressure on all of us, really accepting that that's where this is going, but also doing the work so that the outcome that we all fear is not inevitable.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's it. Those are all good points. Okay, this is a good time to take a short break. We're going to be right back with Stephen Beschloss.
Welcome to the 5-8. This is what we do here.
The 5-8, your Friday night hang. We take five of the week's most notable and newsworthy topics and spend 8 minutes covering each one.
Yeah, it, like everything else associated with Trump, it's a walking disaster.
Prosecution is important because it's the only thing that starts to puncture their personality cults.
I really do need people to remember, like, tell Americans history. Tell the actual story that this country actually did that.
What we need to be selling out there is that we are the antidote to chaos, that we are actually just for responsible, effective government.
There is no greater issue that sums up democracy versus fascism than abortion. There is nothing more authoritarian than the state telling a woman that she must carry to term
forced birth,
a pregnancy that she does not want.
Five segments, 3 minutes of evolving animation by Chunk, two revved up hosts, one comic interlude.
It's not the end of the world, just a Twitter.
A special guest.
Basically, what we are now is bailout nation in banks.
Because nowadays, elections are not about facts.
And as many cocktails as we deem necessary.
So I'm calling this a Dinesh D'Souza.
When they go low, bury them. They're already down in the gutter.
Join me, Greg Oliar, and LB, Stephanie Koff.
Our rants to one another end up being this show. This is what we decided to do with our friendship.
Friday nights, live, 5 Pacific, 8 Eastern. It's the 5-8.
I guess it's okay. People seem to like it.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money. That'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me in a courtroom how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, if I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized.
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
Okay, we're back with Stephen Beschloss. I want to go back a ways now and not talk about Trump for a few minutes, if you don't mind.
There are other things inside my head, I swear.
Now, I was digging through your archives, and you spent time in Russia back in Moscow and St. Petersburg in the 90s and in the early aughts, which I think is a super fascinating time to have been there. And from your descriptions of it, it seems like it was a place that was, you know, sort of optimistic, trending upward. And obviously that did not hold.
Right.
The upward trend did not hold. So I'm just curious what your take is now, having been there, having been around the Russian people. What did you see happen? What do you think about Putin? How has Putin changed? Just what do you think about when you look at what's happening in Russia now?
Well, there's a big question. So, I probably spent in the 90s, particularly the early 90s, probably in Moscow 20 times. I was living part of that time in Helsinki, but I also was living in New York as well. And I was kind of going back and forth. And actually, I'd written a movie that was set in New York City. And I thought, you know what, if I reset this story, it was kind of noir love story, reset it in Moscow in the early days after the collapse of the Soviet Union, it adds a whole other layer in terms of what was going on. And, we still haven't made the movie. That's a whole nother story about money raising, and especially to make a movie in Russia in that time that was so volatile. But I had the chance to be there, you know, right before and right after the collapse in December of 1991. And, you know, to me, it was just fascinating to be there because that was a time when, people woke up in the morning and their country no longer existed. Like, now what? That was tumultuous and difficult. You know, 60 rubles, which was a month's salary, became enough to buy a couple of Snickers bars. And so, you know, you would go to the metro stations and the tunnels underneath them, the viaducts, and people would be lined up on the street selling a pair of silk stockings or a silver cup or a child's, you know, doll or something. You know, people were struggling to live. And so those early years in the 90s were really tough for people. They were hopeful because suddenly the world opened up and there was a sense of optimism and the opportunity to connect with the West. And they saw that early on as a kind of idealistic paradise, even that the world outside was going to be this better place that now they could be a part of. And gradually that began to go away, that they realized that maybe the West wasn't the idyllic like they thought it was, and the opportunities for them were maybe not everything that they hoped for. Fast forward a bit, then you've got Putin coming in, and you know, in a country that was never very wedded to democracy anyway, you know, they returned to a strong man who started to turn things around with the economy, and things started to get better, and suddenly there was more lights in Moscow, and suddenly there was more investment in a lot of the visible things in their world, and income started to go back up, and so people were willing to let everything else happen from there. So, I think for me, that's the context. And I think, I just give you one more story around the time of the bombing of the Russian White House when Yeltsin was still in power. I remember talking to a lot of people who said, oh, I really wish we were more like China, not like America and democracy in the West. More like China, because they had figured out how to have capitalism and to have kind of centralized power from the country to be able to make sure that things worked. So it was clear that Putin was able to take advantage of its natural embedded DNA to be able to to be in the position that he's in. And for him, of course, something I think a lot of the people in the West missed. I'm thinking of Angela Merkel, for example, who thought, like, you can deal with this guy, you can negotiate with this guy, we can bring him into the Democratic fold. And boy, they missed it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he played him, you know, he played a succession of U.S. presidents on both from both parties. And that, you know, that's what happened. But did you see, was there any indication that he would go this wackadoodle? Because invading Ukraine like this is
well, you know. Yeah, of course, because he said early on that, you know, that in his view, the Soviet Union, you know, never should have gone away. You know, look, he lived really well during the Soviet Union period, you know, in his life, you know, as a KGB agent in East Germany and otherwise, you know, he did very well during that period. So he has a rosy memory about the good old days. And, you know, he had said a number of times that he was interested in putting back together the collection of republics that comprise the Soviet Union. You know, one of those people, the kind of Russian nationalist who believed in kind of greater Russia and this idea about the primacy of Russia in the world. So, you know, that instinct, I think, was and is central to who he was then and obviously what he's doing now.
Yeah. Somebody else who was a big fan of the Soviet Union, at least for a certain period of time, is Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, you wrote a book called The Gunman and His Mother, Lee Harvey Oswald, Marguerite Oswald, and the Making of an Assassin. And I didn't know that you wrote this. So the 60th anniversary of the assassination was recently last month. I went through a phase where I went deep diving into all this stuff. So it's always interesting to me. I have a book here. I have this Marina and Lee, which is about his wife.
Book.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I have some books and all this stuff. First of all, what was your impetus for writing, coming at it from this angle? Because I hadn't seen anybody else writing something quite like this.
Yeah, well, and that's you just hit the point, really, which was I kept waiting for somebody else to write this story to really kind of spotlight it. You know, there are parts of Norman Mailer's book, An American Tale, not Driver's American Tragedy, American Tale, that got into a lot of it because records opened up to sort of look at what was going on in the Soviet Union during those years. So there were aspects of that in that book. There was in the Priscilla Johnson Macmillan book that Marina and Lee that you're talking about. But, you know, when I was in Finland in the early 90s, I was working with a Finnish film director. We were actually trying to develop a movie about Lee Harvey Oswald. And it was the first time I came to understand that Oswald spent some time in Helsinki for a week, 10 days, on his way to Moscow, where he got a visa in the Russian embassy in Helsinki, and then sort of went on to Moscow. So I started to pay attention to those years. I think a lot of people don't even know that he was in the Soviet Union. And you know, he was in the Soviet Union up until a year before he came back for that kind of downward spiral of the last year of his life. But also, it got me to pay attention to what was the family dynamic. And I started to pay a lot of attention to who was this mother, and with a very specific idea that all the people who focus on conspiracy theories, they're dismissing the possibility that Lee Harvey Oswald had a reason to commit the murder that he did. And so what I wanted to do was to strip away all the rabbit holes that I could go down with conspiracy theories and just focus on the dynamic of his relationship with his mother. You know, he moved over, you know, over almost two dozen times by the time he was 17. They moved, and he had a very unstable life. His mother was, you know, somebody with delusions of grandeur and a chip on her shoulder. And boy, did she pass that on to the kid. And so he never was able to form very healthy, stable relationships. You know, there were a lot of the makings of somebody whose ability to have a normal life. You know, he didn't finish high school. He didn't think he needed to go to school. He was smarter than all of that. You know, all of the things that undermined his ability to have the skills and the education, the things that he needed to succeed in life. And so I wanted to look at all of that as a way to say, you know, whether you believe in the lone gunman theory or not, look at the trajectory of the boy's life, and particularly the downward spiral of the last year of his life, and you can understand how that person could be that person, you know, in Dealey Plaza, you know, November 22nd, 63, who could commit that murder, even if you doubt it.
Yeah, no, I went down the rabbit holes because I went through a period when I went through, and then I read the Gerald Posner book, Case Closed, yeah. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, it's one guy.
Case Closed.
You know, good title.
Yeah.
I think he you wrote about this when you wrote about JFK, whenever that was, a couple weeks ago, and I think he made a similar point in the book, which is that the popularity of the conspiracy theories and the reason this story won't die is because we Americans don't want it to be that this weirdo incel loser
It doesn't add up. It the event itself, I think it's still legitimately, you know, the crime of the century. It doesn't add up that this person, this untalented, unskilled, you know, nobody could be capable of doing this thing, that it has to be part of a much grander conspiracy. And by the way, the people who believe in the conspiracy also believe that, like, the government is, you know, incompetent and incapable of doing anything. So, you know, I don't know how those two things go together, but I think the story couldn't be more important still today, because in many ways, the unraveling of our belief in what's true and what's not, obviously trust in government, you know, all of those things has broken down. And I think you can surely draw a line between, you know, the Kennedy assassination to, you know, all the kind of crazy conspiracy stuff going on now.
Yeah, no, I think so. And I think it also maybe Kurt Anderson wrote about this in Fantasyland, like the JFK conspiracy theories and all this stuff has made, like, kind of the center so aware of conspiracy theories that when something happens, like Trump, you know, canoodling with the Russians during the campaign, everyone's like, oh no, it sounds like a conspiracy theory. It can't be true. But sometimes things happen. Sometimes people do actually conspire to do things.
Sure.
You know, and stuff like that. And then I think the other thing is that there's, you know, there's weird things about the day. If you break it down, there's like, oh, the Secret Service did this, and why did he go to the movie theater after, and what was Jack Ruby thinking? But any event like that, any big event, whether it's 9/11 or this or something else, there's going to be, if you just isolate any moment in time, there's going to be weird things that happen.
Right. And let me just say, are we going to find out that the CIA was covering up their incompetence? Yes, we are.
I mean,
I mean, that's the oldest story of every bureaucracy in the world. They're always trying to kind of cover up their failures. And in this case, you know, he did come back from the Soviet Union. You know, the FBI did visit him. I mean, he did have some meetings with the CIA. You know, those things happened because he, you know, sought to defect to the Soviet Union. He was, you know, somebody you would pay attention to, but they obviously didn't do a good enough job. And even, you know, I would say if you take that last month of his life in October of 63, you know, he went to Mexico City. And he was went to the Cuban embassy. He was trying to get a visa to go to Havana. Well, what does that look like? Does that look like he's in a deal with Fidel Castro to be able to, you know, manage this murder of President Kennedy? Or what Marina said at the time, that he had begun reading all about Havana and Cuba and Castro, became increasingly pro-Castro, and had that same thing that he had before he went to the Soviet Union, which was this hope that somewhere there's a better world and I can really have the life that I'm continue to hate and fail at here. So the Russia didn't work. Well, maybe Cuba will.
Yeah.
And it may not be anything more profound than that.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And if you look at the idea that this you know, kind of loserly guy could have accomplished something like this, if you go back and look at all the other presidential assassins, they're all like that. And including Hinckley, who failed but still was, I don't know, a crazy loser, and Gitto and Shulgash, they were all nuts. The only one that wasn't nuts was Booth. You know, but that was Civil War, and I think that was a different, you know.
Yeah, look, I would also say look into, you know, I mean, it's part of my point with the book is look at childhood trauma. You know, look at Sirhan Sirhan. You know, as a kid, he saw lots of murder in the streets of Palestine in the 40s, before he came to the United States as a teenager. I mean, he was not a healthy person. And so, you know, I think you can go through all of these. If you look back at the childhood traumas, and in Oswald's case, you know, he was 13 years old. He was taken into custody for truancy. And during that time, you had psychiatrists and psychologists and social workers over a 3-week period who were able to observe him and interview him and so forth. And they said, you know, this kid needs psychiatric care. He comes from this unstable, unloving family. He needs help. And oh, by the way, so does his mother. And, you know, rather than him getting the help that he needs, this is age 13, you know, his mother yanked him out of New York and the jurisdiction of the courts, you know, back to New Orleans, and he never got the help he needed. So, you know, the red flags were there in terms of, you know, that boy's life. And I think it also, I mean, I think part of why I also wanted to look at it is it not only is an opportunity to look at assassins, you know, what's the nature of that kind of person, you know, what are the makings of, but also to look at the ways in which a lot of the shooters that we're seeing who do the mass shootings, a lot of the same characteristics.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. So yeah, The Gunman and His Mother, that's the name of the book. If anybody listening is interested. Now, you wrote another book in 2011 called Adrift, Charting Our Course Back to a Great Nation. So, how happy are you that Trump made America great again? Is he happy about it?
Yeah. Can we rewrite the subtitle?
No, I think that. But what I wanted to ask is, what did you prescribe in that book? Was any of it done? And what would you prescribe now?
Mm. Well, part of the idea of writing the book was to look what happened after World War II in the United States. You know, you had this kind of post-World War II boom that came from, you know, all the kind of economic growth. You had the GI Bill. You had the rise of the middle class. You know, people were getting college educations. People were able to buy homes. You know, I mean, I was a kid and thinking to myself, like, oh, you know, what makes America special? It's that we have a stable middle class. And that's not something that's just this week or this year, but gee, that's a forever thing, isn't it? And what we saw actually was decline, you know, the decline of the country in lots of ways. I mean, economically, culturally, politically, polarization, you know, all of the things that we can talk about that were emerging and I think were exacerbated under Reagan that led to kind of a disparity and growing polarization, you know, not just in terms of groups and culture and ideas, but also in terms of economic fortune. And, you know, I think we've never really recovered from it. The solutions are in many ways quite simple, which is education, you know, focusing on innovation, focusing on science, you know, all of the things, advancing, expanding public education, all of the things that we've seen the Republicans in these last years work methodically to undermine. And, you know, we used in part the example of of Ireland, and for very specific reasons, because in the 60s, when they were dealing with pretty high levels of poverty and the country was really on its heels, they made a commitment to public education. And within a generation, you know, the whole economy of Ireland and the fortunes of the people and the numbers of people that were leaving the country to be able to get opportunity, they were coming back and the country was prospering. So education. And, you know, that remains, I think, a central battlefield for the coming years.
Yeah, I think that's something it's not counterintuitive either. Like, it makes sense that you would invest in education and then generation later, you would bear the fruit of all of that. Like this, like, you know, Keynesian economics is counterintuitive. Trickle down it's not even counterintuitive. It's just dumb. Right. But that makes perfect sense. There's nothing illogical about it. It's just it goes exactly how you would expect. And the Republicans don't. Why do you think they don't want it? What is it, just to help the rich people and that's it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we all know that if you have a more educated workforce, you know, then they're able to be more productive and the country prospers. So that would be an obvious thing. But I think maybe the simplest answer is, you know, you have billionaires like the Cokes, used to be the Koch brothers, but the whole kind of Koch bunch, who saw, and you know, Betsy DeVos and so forth, who saw an opportunity to further enrich themselves by taking control of public education, you know, with vouchers and all the ways that they could privatize it. So I think that's a key. And you know, the more cynical, and surely in these years, that's usually the worst view you have of things, is the most likely one, which is that they actually do just want to keep people as dumb as power as possible, as a way to keep power over people.
Yeah. No, I agree with both of those. I didn't think of the vouchers, but that's a thing too. Yeah. No, I think that anybody smart, anybody who can think critically, is going to, you know, quickly realize that
they're a danger. They're a danger for them.
Yeah, because what they're doing is dumb and works at against most Americans.
You know, do we need media literacy in this time? We sure do. You know, do we need critical thinkers, not just to come up with, you know, fantastic conspiracy theories, but to be able to look smartly about what's going on and be able to judge what's going on? You know, if you make that harder for people to do, then whoever's in power has a greater ability to manipulate the public.
Yeah, yeah. It's they have better tools now to manipulate, and they're taking away the ability of people to learn more about how to think critically. So combining those things, and speaking of media tools and billionaires who are evil, Elon Musk, you know, Twitter used to be kind of a nice thing. I seem to remember
vaguely.
I wrote a piece, I think the day he took over, in October of, again, I've lost all track of time. And it was Tower of Bab Elon. That was the title. Because I think it really was what happened. I think that he was installed there to destroy it. This is what I think, and nobody's ever going to, I'll die on that hill.
Yeah.
And I wrote a long paragraph about all the things he was going to do to ruin it, and almost every single one of them came to pass.
Wouldn't you be wrong? You know, the world would be a better place if you were wrong in this case.
I know. But alas, no. So, you know, everybody is scattered. That's the sort of takeaway. Some people left because they couldn't handle it anymore. You know, the getting rid of the blue checks made everything more confusing, and you could impersonate people. And then the only people that weren't scattered were like Cat Turd and the Nazis, which, you know, are the people that Elon Musk likes to interact with on Twitter all the time, which is just kind of disgusting. But what's the biggest casualty of this, do you think? And by this, I mean the destruction of Twitter and the kind of splintering of the social media that is going to replace it. And how do we work around it?
Right. So I won't just focus on the way in which it helped all kinds of people's careers to sort of build platforms to be able to communicate with publics that they wouldn't before. You know, there's the creative professional side of things that has all kinds of individual implications. But I think the larger point is that the fracturing, the collapsing of that ecosystem, which was so central, that allowed people to communicate with each other, that allowed progressive communities to build and expand and to engage and communicate all the things that you want to do when you're trying to make sense of the world and respond critically to what's going on. And he broke it. You know, I'm sure you have the same experience that I do, that, you know, the ability to connect with, you know, I mean, I have over 300,000 followers, and I used to be able to see what a lot of people were saying and thinking. And I really valued that as a way for me to understand what was on people's minds. And I can't find it anymore, you know, amidst all of the trolling and all the abuse and the difficulty that people have in whatever way he broke that algorithm so that people don't find each other anymore. But the result is that it's dispersed everyone to everywhere. There's not really a place then once Twitter is gone. You know, there's not a place. I don't know about you. I'm, you know, embarrassingly, I'm on six different social media platforms. Right. And I, you know, we could go through them one by one. And, you know, I mean, I have followings on all of them, but there's not anywhere that I feel like there's a community where there's a real opportunity to engage and have a dialogue. And, you know, look, I think that was exactly what they were trying to do. You break the power of progressive communities by breaking their ability to connect with each other.
Yeah. And they did it. You know, they really did do it. I mean, I owe every, you know, without Twitter, I don't have anything. Nobody knows who I am. And, you know, that really helped me. It helped me in my career, but it also helped me learn stuff. Like you said, I mean, it's not just the algorithms broken, like the trending topics, you click on it. Half the time, I can't even tell why it's trending. You know, it'll be like, it's clearly a sports story. And then, you know, you click on Jets and it's sports and it's supposed to be about the New York Jets and it's not, it's about Jets over somewhere. And it used to be able that they would, you know, if something was trending, you could tell why. Now you can't even tell why. And, you know, the problem with the new platforms is that there's no, you know, for the most part, there's no direct messaging, which is one of the advantages of Twitter is that you can, you know, 100%
connect with people at a personal level when there's a reason, when there's a need for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now you, you know, you can't. It's just that there, unless you have ever, you know, someone's phone number or something or email address or whatever, it's just not the same thing. It's not the same immediacy. And because there's so many different platforms, who's in this place, who's in that place. And there's people I've forgotten about that I'm like, oh shit, I haven't heard from that person in a while. What's going on with them? And they're there.
That's the thing.
Yeah. I just don't see it in my feed anymore. You know,
you lose the communication. And you know, that's once you break that, you know, what we're learning is it's hard to put that back together. You know, nobody else has sort of figured out, you know, what's the ecosystem that allows that to happen. And, you know, and at the same time for it, not just to be a home for all the abuse. You know, I'm thinking back a year ago, and it was actually right around sort of Thanksgiving and just after that, where I was getting so much abuse, right? So much abuse from all the, you know, all the trolls, all the, you know, neo-Nazis and all the bigots, all of it. And you know, I never used to block people. And then I started to do it. I think in the last year, I've blocked over 10,000 people.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Well, you have to. Yeah.
It was the only way to do it. And look, I have a lot of friends that just said, I'm done, I'm exiting, I'm out, you know, I'm out of X, I'm exiting, you know, that's necessary to do that. And, you know, I completely get it. And at the same time, I think there's a, you know, there's a reason to continue to also to keep your voice in there. You know, maybe a little bit differently, maybe a little less frequently. I'm not trying to, you know, help Elon Musk advance, but I am interested in being able to keep the communication alive, you know, and hope that maybe that someday it won't be the Saudis or whoever else is manipulating him that will be, you know, deciding our fate.
Yeah. The other piece was the immediacy of finding out what was happening. Like I remember when Michael Cohen was testifying, this is 4 or 5 years ago, and about who client number 2 or 3, whatever it was. I was following the feed of whoever was in the courtroom. So when we found out it was Sean Hannity, I knew almost immediately, probably within 2 minutes of everyone finding out.
Well, that's the beauty of the platform. I actually think that when I started paying attention to Twitter as a thing was when I was trying to find the decision. I don't remember what decision, but some Supreme Court decision. I started going on Twitter like every, you know, 30 seconds, thinking that would be the fastest way to find what the result was in that particular ruling. And, you know, again, we don't really have that anymore.
No, it's blue sky was pretty good during the weekend of the Hamas war. I have to say I was able to deep dive relatively quickly, but it's not the same. It's not, there's not enough people there.
Yeah.
So a couple more questions. I don't want to keep you too long.
Sure.
I've said many times on this podcast, and I've written many times, Joe Biden, best president of my lifetime. I think that, you know, I made a bet with my brother who doesn't think this. I like, you know, 25, 30 years from now, when you look at the rankings, he's going to be high. Whatever he is right now, he's going to be high. And what do you think? Where do you put him, you know, presidents of the last 50 years or the last, you know, the 20th century? How do you think he's doing? Where do you rate him?
Yeah, so I'm, you know, I am a huge positive fan, you know, of the man, you know, who, if you do remember, it's almost hard to remember at this point. You know, we were pretty deep into the reality of COVID when he took office, and you know, and you had a former president who wasn't very interested in, you know, getting vaccines into people's arms, and you know, Biden made a big point in the first 100 days about getting whatever it was, 100 million shots, or you know, I think within 150 or 200 days, it was, you know, 200 million shots. shots. You know, all of that started the turnaround. And, you know, obviously that's had all kinds of implications, not only saving lives, but also creating the conditions for this incredible economic growth in terms of low unemployment and incredible, you know, 14 million plus new jobs and huge manufacturing numbers. You know, and then you go through all of it. I mean, somebody who really has focused on climate change, which along with the dangers facing democracy, to me is the, you know, is the other, you know, most significant existential danger the country's facing. And he's taken it seriously. I think he can do more, but he's, you know, he's put hundreds and, you know, he's put billions of dollars into trying to turn the economy around in terms of electric vehicles and in terms of, you know, insulation for homes and all the things that start to make a difference with that. You know, he's passed significant legislation, but I think the, you know, so, you know, where does he get placed? I mean, I don't know that I would say he's the, you know, he's the new FDR. I'm reluctant to do it, but, you know, it's hard to even think back about the Obama years, you know, and I think, you know, you and I would agree that he was a, you know, a great president and we're grateful that he was there, but he almost seems, you know, in the world we're in, almost irrelevant. And Biden has been able to embrace this time under extreme circumstances and to advocate, you know, not only now for democracy, but to be able to, in the most sort of improbable ways, to be able to pass significant legislation, including, you know, investment in infrastructure, which, by the way, has had all kinds of impacts for all kinds of red states as well as blue states mm-hmm. around the country. So, you know, he's also held on to this idea about, you know, America as a, you know, as a, you know, as a democracy, as a place of beauty, as a place where unity is possible, where there is still the idea of this optimism that through government that we can actually, you know, improve the lives of people and you know, and the future is better than the past. And, you know, it feels a little bit like he's struggling for that to connect. You know, most people are extremely pessimistic and, you know, we can talk about why. But for me, yeah, Biden, I mean, I just think Biden's done a great job.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree with everything you said. And I'm surprised, you know, when he went in there, I thought, okay, well, he'll be fine. He'll put good people in there. He'll be kind of a transitional figure. And no. You know, he's not been that. He's been really a leader. And I think morally, too, you know, like he's clearly not an asshole, which is nice.
It is. You know? It is a relief. It's almost possible to forget, you know, just, you know, in the relief of having a decent human being in the office, you know, and how that makes everyday life just a little bit better.
Yeah. Yeah. That's perfectly put. So I have one more question for you. Before I let you go. So do you still get to stay at Ritz-Carlton for free now? Or and if so, can you hook me up? Like, what's the, you know, talk about that, because that seemed really interesting. And you were staying at the, you know, working for these fancy hotels. I love good hotels, by the way. I'm a big fan of good hotels.
I love good hotels. I should tell you about the what was the Ritz-Carlton in Moscow, because I was there before it opened. And was in the presidential suite, by the way, which overlooks Red Square, you know, where the infamous place where Trump was supposed to have been peed on. But and by the way, that room is it's a safe room. I mean, if the whole building gets bombed, that room would survive. It's, you know, and it was a lot of Kazakhstan money that built it and on and on and on. But to be clear, so I was for a while the editor of the Ritz-Carlton's hotel magazine, and I stayed at a few, but the deal wasn't that that journalists were given access to all their properties, as beautiful a picture as that would be. You know, they still didn't really make it happen for us.
That's too bad. That's too bad. Because I'm like, oh, that sounded good. I'm going to pretend that you didn't say that and imagine that you were there. But that's cool that you were in the one in Moscow. I didn't even put that together, that you were in the room. So that's interesting.
So I just give this really fast. So 2007 is when it opened. I went there just before it opened. And, you know, I hadn't been back in Moscow for a decade. So I was last there in 97. I made a film in St. Petersburg and February of 97 called The Miracle, about an American TV journalist who goes to Russia with the impossible assignment of filming a miracle. And it was a kind of fictional documentary. And we interviewed a lot of, you know, religious leaders and spiritualists and psychics and a lot of weird and interesting people to ask them, where can we find a miracle? That was the deal. But then, you know, I wasn't back for a decade. And so I said to my connections, you know, before the hotel opened, like, take me, I've got four nights in Moscow, take me to every high-end club, restaurant, everything, so I can see what it was. And the piece that I wrote was sort of, you know, close your eyes, it's 1997, and it's, you know, a struggling city, but things are beginning to happen. Now open them a decade later, and oh my God, you know, you would think that it was just another Western city with all the lights and all the restaurants and all the shops and all the things that looked like almost anywhere else. And so, you know, that was an opportunity to do that then. Now, you know, fast forward to, you know, Trump, Putin invading Ukraine, and you see where all of that has just been turned backwards again.
Yeah, it's sad. It really is sad.
Sorry to leave you in that place.
No, it's okay. It's okay. I'm just gonna imagine the presidential suite at the Ritz-Carlton. So yeah, that's fine. We can end on that lux
overlooking Red Square. Yeah, where you can see, you know, the future and the past of the world.
There you go. Okay, so you mentioned before you're on, what, six different social medias? So which ones are they? Where can people find you?
Oh, gosh. So Post, Mastodon, Spoutable. I'm already running out. Well, I'm still lingering on X. But, you know, the most meaningful thing is please do check out America America. It's america.substack.com. You know, that's where it's not just 280 characters. I'm writing, you know, genuine essays where you can actually, you know, say something. And, you know, I have a fantastic, growing, thoughtful, interested, engaged community that really cares about democracy and justice and, you know, the survival of such things.
Yeah. And I like, you know, one of the many things I like about your Substack is that, like me, you operate on the tip jar model. So you don't like do the paywall, really.
Right.
Which I like. I think that that's an effective model. And, you know, that's just my personal preference.
No, so. I mean, look, again, not to be too moral about it, but I mean, I think it's the duty that we have right now. If we're gonna do the work to articulate what's going on, you know, make sure that people can find it and read it.
Yeah, I agree. I could not agree more. I want people to read what I write.
Yeah,
it's really it's that.
And
simple.
You write well, and you have something important to say. So, you know, don't put up that paywall.
Right. Yeah. That's it. That's it. No paywalls. Stephen Beschloss, thanks so much for joining me today.
Greg, thank you so much.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fawcett. Serena Zabriskie, Marie Cast, and Martha Acuna provided the introduction in Ukrainian, French, and Spanish, respectively. Voice talent is by Stephanie St. John and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kenai Williams, Kimberly Johnson, and everyone else at MSW Media. If you'd like to support this program, get three friends to subscribe. The more downloads I get, the better the show does. You can also subscribe to The 5-8, the live YouTube show I do with my friend Stephanie Koff, a.k.a. LB. Tune in tonight for your Friday night hang. Most importantly, please subscribe to The Prevail Substack, with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $6 monthly or $55 yearly subscription funds my work on the column and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely, be kind to each other, try and enjoy yourself, and until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.